The presence of the video camera and other evidence, such as his family's absence, showed that the crime had certainly been premeditated, and Crutchley's repeated savaging of the hitchhiker, even after she had lost a lot of blood, demonstrated brutality and taking advantage of someone who was vulnerable. Crutchley had told the hitchhiker that he would continue to assault her again and again, and this was certainly mentally as well as physically injurious. I further testified that John Crutchley had all the hallmarks of a serial killer and gave my reasons for saying so. The stack of credit cards and other trophies I believe to have come from missing women, the unlimited sexual experimentation, the fact that the hitchhiker would have died if she had been subjected to the blood draining for another day, the Fitzjohn case in Virginia, and so on. I drew similarities between Crutchley and Ted Bundy, who was then awaiting execution, and whose maneuvers to delay that execution shared headlines with the Crutchley case in Florida. The judge did exceed the guidelines and gave Crutchley 25 years to life in prison and 50 years of parole, a sentence that would keep Crutchley more or less under the state's control for the rest of his life. Norm Wolfinger sent a letter of thanks to Director Webster for allowing me to testify, and told me personally that had I not testified, Crutchley's sentence might not have exceeded the guidelines. That was nice to hear, because I believe that Crutchley ought to be behind bars for a long stretch. But there are times when I wonder whether pursuing these dangerous people so assiduously is accomplishing the protection of society. With good time, law enforcement people figure, Crutchley will be out in 1998, and maybe even sooner. In the criminal justice system, nothing means anything anymore. Life imprisonment doesn't mean life. Death doesn't mean death. And 25 years means 12 and a half, or maybe even 6. But don't get me started on that. In October of 1989, I was preparing to retire from the Bureau and had long since turned over the day-to-day work of profiling to others at Quantico. However, men who had worked with me in the Bureau, or whom I had taught at the Academy, were all over the country. And when they called to ask for assistance, it was me personally they wanted, and I always said yes. That's how I got involved in a case that took me back in time, both in the type of crime and in its location. In broad daylight, on a weekday afternoon just prior to Halloween, 12-year-old Amy Mihaljevic disappeared at a small shopping center directly opposite the police station in Bay Village, Ohio. This happened right down the road from the site of the osteopathic hospital of Dr. Sam Shepard near Cleveland. Shepard's was the most notorious murder case of the 1950s and 1960s in the Cleveland area. Amy's photograph, peering out from a missing girl poster, could have been that of any 10,000 12-year-old girls in America's heartland. A blue-eyed, brown-haired, freckle-faced girl with outsized earrings and a turquoise jumpsuit. You looked at that photo and hoped that it was all a mistake, that she'd turn the corner and come home soon. And yet, you knew there was slim chance of that. I had been an agent in the Cleveland office of the FBI before transferring to Quantico, and so I was a former colleague of John Dunn, who became involved in the case of Amy's disappearance. Another agent concerned with the case, Dick Wren, had also worked with me on a case in Genoa, Ohio, in 1980. Both men asked me to come and have a look at the evidence. I was attending a conference of the American Academy of Forensic Sciences, held in Cincinnati, and over a weekend I drove to Bay Village. The FBI had gotten into this case quickly, and our involvement followed the model established in the Joubert murders. I had frequently lectured about the interagency coordination that had been the key to success in that case, and the Joubert task force model had been followed in several subsequent cases. When I arrived in Bay Village, Dunn had already established his task force headquarters in the suburban police station, and he had 24 agents assisting the local authorities. Amy had been abducted, but nothing more was really certain. There had been no ransom demands, no body found, no signs of a struggle. The main witness was Amy's younger brother, who told us that in the days prior to the abduction, Amy had received a series of telephone calls at the house from a man who the brother said had given Amy the following pitch. "I work with your mom, and she's just been promoted, and we want to get her a present. Meet me in the shopping center after school and help me pick out a gift. Keep this a secret and don't tell anyone, because we don't want your mom to know about the gift." Amy had asked whether she could tell her brother, and the man said she shouldn't. Amy agreed, saying that her brother was a real blabbermouth. After she hung up, however, she did tell her brother, who later recounted the conversation to the authorities. Several people had seen Amy talking to a man in a car at the shopping center, and they gave partial descriptions that were made into a sketch that filled the lower part of Amy's missing person poster and flyer. The sketch was of a white man, fairly youthful, but otherwise undistinguished in the witnesses' minds, who might or might not have worn glasses. Dunn, who had been a priest and a police officer before joining the FBI, sat down with me and we made a profile. If John Jubert had been on the streets, I would have suspected him or someone quite similar to him, although Jubert killed boys and not girls. Many of the characteristics that I felt were important were similar to those of Jubert. I wanted the police to look for a man in his late 20s or early 30s who was introverted and a loner, relatively unsuccessful in life, unmarried, not overly educated, but not stupid. This would be a man with no military service, but with a propensity for spending a lot of time around kids. His smoothness in conning Amy into the car argued for his knowing something about children and the way their minds work, and I thought it likely that a person who preferred children's company would not have put himself in a situation such as the military, where male bonding is part of the experience. It might just be children of both sexes he was after, but it was more likely he sought out only girls. In either case, he would be uncomfortable with male and female adults. I felt strongly that Amy's abduction was his first offense because there was no record of any similar abductions in the area, and because the abductor had exposed himself to so much danger by his phone call and by making the abduction in such a public place as the parking lot, where many people could see him. I thought that the abductor might have conned Amy into his car, taken her to his home on the pretext of getting money or a greeting card or some such, even offered her cookies and milk, and played with her until she became frightened and started to resist, at which point he might have been convinced that he had to kill her. I told the authorities to keep an eye out for a person who might try to interject himself into the investigation. It wasn't much, but there was very little to go on. In January, I returned to Bay Village, where the authorities had leads on 4 or 5 suspects who more or less fit the profile. One was a stable hand who worked at a place where Amy had taken riding lessons. I thought he was more mentally disordered than the man who had smoothly talked Amy into a car. Nonetheless, the police hauled him in and gave him truth serum. He easily passed that test. Another suspect was a police officer, and a third was a fireman. I didn't think they fit the bill either because education, discipline, successful adaptation, and male bonding are essential to obtaining and keeping such jobs as they held. A fourth suspect was a youngish man who had come to the police department and volunteered to distribute the handbills with Amy's picture. Now, many other people in the community had also volunteered, but Dunn and Wren had felt that this particular man was a very likely suspect. He was single, in his early 30s, lived alone, and worked as a stock boy at a discount price club. He had graduated from high school but had no further education and no military service. He did, however, have a very severe skin problem that caused his face to break out so badly that he was taking medication for the condition. It was thought that his skin condition prevented him from having relationships with women. In addition to volunteering, the young man had sent a sympathy card to Amy's mother from a concerned friend and signed his name. In it were 2 cheap decorative pins with a note saying that the mother could wear one and that when Amy returned home, Mrs. Mihaljevic could give her daughter the other one. I agreed with Dunn and Wren that this was a likely suspect, and I wanted to know where the pins had come from. We determined that they were sold in the place where the man worked. under the guise of trying to thank him for his volunteer work, Dunn and I went to see him. He lived in a studio apartment in an inexpensive townhouse complex. The place had a fold-up bed and a tiny kitchen and bathroom. After bringing up the volunteer work, we asked him some questions about himself. Yes, he said he had a girlfriend. We later learned that she was a woman with a small child from an early marriage. I doubted there had been any sexual activity between them. After a while, we deliberately turned up the heat. Why was he so involved in this investigation? Was it possible that he was the one who had picked Amy up? I tried to minimize what he might have done, saying that it was possible that the child had had some difficulties, maybe fell down and hurt her head, and that he'd been afraid to tell anyone about it. Maybe there'd been an accident. He protested vehemently, saying that he had had nothing to do with Amy's disappearance. We had no authority to search the place, but when the man went to the bathroom, I looked it over as best I could. My focus was to see whether there was anything in the apartment that could have been a trophy of Amy or of any other child. I felt it likely that he might have killed her in this apartment and taken her elsewhere, and I had the task force prepared to move in and open the drains, take the hair out of brushes, and so on, if we got the slightest hint of involvement. There was no such hint, however, and we left the apartment. Coming out of the interview, I told Dunn that my gut said this was the guy, and he thought so too, but there was no proof. 3 weeks later, Amy's body was found about 50 miles away. She still wore her turquoise jumpsuit, but it had been taken off her body and put on again after death. The dump site was a field just off an exit to I-71, the main highway that connects Cleveland with Cincinnati. Amy's body was well preserved and had not been there very long, perhaps a week at the most. The coroner thought it likely that she had died in October and that her body had been preserved by cold until the moment of dumping. The day that the finding of Amy's body was reported in the newspapers, the suspect mixed dry gas in a glass of Coke and drank it, committing suicide. As soon as the police learned of his death, Dunn and I recommended a quick search of his apartment. They obtained a warrant and went to the townhouse complex, only to learn they were too late. Even before the wake, his family had already cleaned the place down to the walls and given his clothes to Goodwill. Amy Mihaljevic's abduction and murder is still being carried on the Bay Village Police books as an unsolved crime, and we will probably never know the truth of the matter. However, there have been no similar crimes in the community in the past 2 years, and maybe that's all that can be hoped for. 8. Staging, Pattern of Deceit. In this chapter, I'll take you through a handful of cases that initially baffled the police because the criminals had been so clever at staging the crime scenes. One of the helpful consequences of our experience in profiling and our research into the minds and criminal methods of incarcerated murderers is extra knowledge about how some organized criminals work hard at throwing the police off their track. A disorganized, violent criminal never bothers himself about deliberately misleading the police. You already know about stagings from detective novels or from reports about such common occurrences as husbands who have killed their mates in a fit of anger, then tried to make the scene appear as if a burglar had come in and murdered the poor wife. The police almost always see through such stagings quickly. The cases in this chapter follow a similar pattern but are far more ingenious. Indeed, in all instances, they had the regular authorities pretty much fooled for a while. In Columbus, Georgia, one February evening in 1978, a group of middle-aged and elderly women were at a party together, and the main topic of discussion was the mysterious series of killings of 7 other elderly women in Columbus. At one point during the evening, in a demonstration of how completely the fear of the killer had gripped the city, 7 of the women guests emptied their purses, revealing 7 handguns that fell out onto the carpet. In fact, the killings were terrible. Elderly women, some of whom had been raped, and all of whom had been strangled to death with nylon stockings in their own homes. Everyone was terrified of the stocking strangler. Some forensic evidence obtained at the crime scenes suggested that the killer was a black male, but the police had been unable to narrow the search beyond that. There was tremendous community pressure on the Columbus police and their chief. Fortunately, that chief was not the stereotypical backwoods lawman, but one who had an advanced degree in police sciences. Nonetheless, he was reluctant to do, as the media asked, call the Georgia Bureau of Investigation and the FBI for help, because he didn't want to lose control of the case. Then the chief received an unusual handwritten letter on U.S. Army stationery addressed to him. In the original, the capital and lowercase letters are all about the same size. It read, in part, as follows. Dear Sir, we are an organization composed of 7 members. I'm writing this letter to inform you that we have one of your Columbus women captive. Her name is Gail Jackson. Since that coroner said that the strangler is black, we decided to come here and try to catch him, or put more pressure on you. I see now more pressure is needed. At this point, Gail Jackson is still living. If that strangler is not caught by 1 June 1978, you will find Gail Jackson's body on Winnington Road. If he's still not caught by 1 September 1978, the victims will double. You have until Sunday for reply. Don't think we are bluffing. We are, call, the forces of evil. The letter cautioned the authorities not to make too much of the fact that the letter was written on military stationery. Anyone could get hold of that, the writer suggested. The message of the letter seemed to be clear. An organization of white men was going on a vigilante offensive, and black women were going to die until the black killer of the elderly white woman was caught. Succeeding letters announced that the forces of evil had come from Chicago and that the police chief was to communicate with the organization through radio or television messages. A demand for $10,000 in order to keep Gail Jackson alive was also made. The chief at first disregarded the letters, but then he sent them to the newspapers, hoping perhaps to flush out the sender. And he also rechanneled some of his resources from going after the stocking strangler into chasing the forces of evil organization. He and his policemen looked hard for 7 white men, even telephoning to Chicago to see what the police there knew about such a white supremacist group. Then came a phone call to the MP desk at Fort Benning, Georgia, the large military reservation that abuts Columbus. A caller, claiming to be a representative of the forces of evil, said that Gail Jackson was going to be killed and asked why didn't the police do something about it. 2 days after that phone call, at the end of March 1978, I was in Atlanta, Georgia, having dinner with an old Army CID buddy, Tom McGreevy, who had become deputy director of the Georgia Bureau of Investigation, for whom I was conducting a course at the Georgia Police Academy. Tom told me something about the Columbus case. He had become involved after the Columbus chief had finally realized that it was no longer in his interest to keep the state authorities at arm's length. He showed me the forces of evil letters and asked whether I could help. In addition to the letters, we had available some recorded telephone calls to the MP desk. Analyzing the communications, I immediately discounted the idea that Gail Jackson was about to be killed by a group of 7 white men in reaction to the death of the 7 elderly white women. The evidence pointed precisely in the opposite direction. I thought the probable culprit was a single black male. The style of writing in the letters, as well as the accent of the voice on the telephone call tape, made that a reasonable assumption. Once I had figured that out, the rest was easy. The letters seemed quite clearly to be an attempt to lead the authorities away from the most likely suspect, a person who was a known associate of Gail Jackson's. But what other reason would the killer have to write such a letter? Possibly to prevent the police from getting close to him because he had already killed Jackson? It seemed likely that he had penned the letters in order to disguise the death. My analysis of the letters and the voice on the calls was seconded, independently, by the FBI's psycholinguistic consultant, Dr. Murray Mirren. The MP desk at Fort Benning received another call on the 3rd of April that said Gail Jackson's body could be found 100 meters from Fort Benning. A quick search did locate her body, and the information went from the base authorities to McGreevy to me. Jackson had been a prostitute, well known in some of the bars in the vicinity of the military reservation. The medical examiner estimated that she had been dead about 5 weeks, that is, she had been killed prior to the time the letters had been written, as I had suspected. Now, with some more details in hand, I was able to come up with a more detailed profile. Often the best way to approach a profile is through victimology, through looking at the victim's background. Was this a low-risk or a high-risk victim? What areas did she frequent? What was her daily routine? What was her lifestyle? Who would she be likely to consort with in such a lifestyle? Jackson, also known by several other names, had been a black prostitute who plied her trade among the black servicemen of the large military installation at Fort Benning, and she had frequented the streets and bars near the base. I concluded that the killer was someone so close to Gail Jackson that his name or identity would inevitably be turned up in any investigation of her life, and that had been the reason for his attempt to lead the authorities 180 degrees in the opposite direction, that is, away from his own characteristics. He had chosen to portray Jackson's abductors as seven white men from Chicago. I pegged him as a single black male, 25 to 30 years of age, an enlisted man on the Fort Benning complex, possibly a military policeman or artilleryman. I was certain the killer was in the military because of the references in the letters and phone calls to meters and the way he kept calling automobiles vehicles. His inadequate English made it certain that he was not a college graduate, therefore not a commissioned officer, and I thought it likely that his rank would be no more than an E6. As for his age, the listener already knows that most serial killers are in their 20s or 30s. I guessed he was in his late 20s, because that would be commensurate with a person of modest education in a middle-ranking military position. The latest Forces of Evil letters had mentioned the name of another black woman, Irene, whose last name the writer did not know, and said she too would be killed if no action was taken. I guessed that she was also already dead, and I recommended that all the phone booths on the base be kept under surveillance. They were, and the recording system was in operation. But when a call came in, the MP at the desk was so upset that he forgot to turn on the recorder. Following the instructions of the caller, authorities found a second black female, Irene Thirkield, dead on a rifle range at the fort. She, too, had been a prostitute. Armed with my profile and the knowledge that both women had been prostitutes, GBI narcotics agents interviewed the patrons of a nightclub on the outskirts of Fort Benning frequented by black soldiers. Several people knew both prostitutes and readily named a man who had acted as their pimp. 2 days after the profile was circulated, the military and civilian authorities arrested William H. Hance, a specialist fourth grade attached to an artillery unit at the fort. Confronted with the handwriting, voice evidence, and shoe prints taken at the crime scenes, Hance admitted that the letters had been a complete hoax and confessed to the killing of the two women, who he said had been involved with him in prostitution and low-level drug trade, as well as to the killing of a third female at Fort Benning in September of the previous year. Later, he was identified as the murderer of another young black woman at another post where he had been stationed earlier, Fort Benjamin Harrison in Indiana. As McGreevy said in a letter of appreciation to the director of the FBI, "The profile data turned out to be right on the nose in every respect." And on behalf of his agency and that of the Columbus Police, he expressed his gratitude to me and to the Bureau for the wholehearted professional and immediate efforts that supported the investigation when we needed all the help we could get. I had initially thought it likely that Hance had also committed the strangulation murders of the elderly white women, but this possibility was dismissed when the forensic evidence did not match. Released from chasing the figment of Hance's imagination, the Columbus police and the GBI continued their investigation. Good police work finally paid off. In one of the early murders, a pistol had been stolen from the victim's house, and later the police got a tip concerning this pistol. The weapon was traced to Kalamazoo, Michigan, then to some other cities, and ultimately to a small town in Alabama, where the man who admitted having it said it had been given to him by his nephew, Carlton Gary, who lived in Columbus. Gary, it turned out, was a black man who had killed in New York and gone to prison for his murders. Then he had escaped, hidden out in South Carolina, and robbed many restaurants before returning to his place of birth. His mother had been a maid in many of the homes of the women that Gary had strangled. Gary was apprehended, convicted, and sentenced to death. He is still in prison, as is William Hance. Just after the Forces of Evil case, the Army requested that the FBI conduct training sessions for the Army in hostage negotiations, and I donned my military hat and went over to Germany to teach at the school. Thereby hangs a long story, but to shorten it, I'll just say that during my 20 years in the Bureau, I maintained my reserve status in the Army. Since this was technically speaking against Bureau policy, I now and then had to do a bit of tap dancing to be permitted to keep my commission. Every other government agency not only allows but encourages its employees to be in the reserves. The CIA even has its own reserve unit that meets at Langley, but the FBI doesn't like divided loyalties. Nonetheless, from time to time, the Army would request that the Bureau provide experienced teachers for hostage negotiations or other similar subjects, and the task would fall to me. On this particular trip, I asked my associate John Douglas to come along as my backup. John had participated in a tense hostage negotiation in Milwaukee that was successfully resolved, and had also followed me in teaching our hostage negotiation course at Quantico. On the way home from the school, we stopped by prior arrangement at Bramshill, the British Police College about 100 miles from London, that is the leading training facility for law enforcement in the British Isles, the counterpart of Quantico. I hoped to establish some contacts there and stir up some interest in an exchange program. We met the commandant of the college and some other high-level officials, conducted a few guest lectures, and sat in on some classes. The British expressed quite a bit of skepticism about what we American blokes said we could tell about a case just from looking at crime scene photographs, and this became the meat of an after-hours session at the local lounge to which the lawmen regularly repaired at the end of the day. Douglas and I sat in that lounge drinking beer with John Domay, a police officer attending the college just then, and a man who was investigating the most notorious multiple slaying case that had surfaced since Jack the Ripper. The unknown killer was called the Yorkshire Ripper, and he had murdered 8 women in Yorkshire, most of them prostitutes, over the course of the previous 4 years. There were 3 survivors of his attacks, but all they had been able to agree upon was that the attacker had been a white man of adult age and average size. The police had no good suspects. For instance, they were suggesting to police stations that the killer would be a man born between the years of 1924 and 1959. That is, anywhere between 20 and 55 years of age. Domay described the crimes to us. Much in the manner that we would later come to associate with Ted Bundy, the killer bludgeoned women and then sexually assaulted them as they lay dying. After death, he mutilated their bodies with a knife. In the past year, Domay told us, Chief Inspector George Oldfield had received 2 letters in the mail from Jack the Ripper, and then a tape recording also sent through the mail. A 3rd letter had been received by a major newspaper. These had become the focus of a renewed manhunt. Oldfield, near retirement age, was under considerable public pressure to find the killer before he struck again. This was the largest case ever in Oldfield's jurisdiction. He had many people trying to second-guess him and criticizing the police for not being able to apprehend the killer. Oldfield had the tape electronically analyzed, the background noises amplified so they might be identified, and was going all out to share his information with the public. A lot of time and money was being spent on tracking the killer through use of this tape. You could telephone a number and listen as the tape was played for you, then offer your comments if you thought you recognized the voice or even the precise origin of the fairly thick backcountry Geordie accent. Hundreds of police officers were roaming the area of the murders with tape recorders, playing the tape for the citizenry and soliciting their comments. And the tape was also being broadcast on radio and television. We said we wanted to see the crime scene photographs and offered to do a profile of the likely offender after we'd seen them, but such photographs weren't available at Bramshill just then. However, someone had a copy of the tape recording and proceeded to play it for us. The speaker was an adult male and spoke with a slow, measured voice. There was considerable background noise, and the tape lasted about 2 minutes. "I'm Jack. I see you are still having no luck catching me. I have the greatest respect for you, George, but you are no nearer catching me now than 4 years ago when I started. I reckon your boys are letting you down, George. You can't be much good, can you? The only time they came near touching me was a few months back in Chapeltown when I was disturbed. Even then, it was a uniformed copper, not a detective. I warned you in March that I'd strike again, but I couldn't get there. I'm not quite sure when I'll strike again, but it will definitely be sometime this year. Maybe September, October. Even sooner if I get the chance. There's plenty of them knocking about. They never learn, do they, George? I'll keep on going for quite a while yet. I can't see myself being nicked just yet. Even if you do get near, I'll probably top myself first. Well, it's been nice chatting to you, George." Jack also encouraged Oldfield to listen to the catchy tune on the tape, which turned out to be an extract from a record entitled "Thank You for Being a Friend." By the time we finished listening to the tape, more than a few people had gathered at our table. Under the needling stimulus of the Brits, I said to Domé, "You realize, of course, that the man on the tape is not the killer, don't you?" He was thunderstruck. John Douglas concurred in my evaluation of the tape. It was a hoax designed deliberately to flummox the police and perpetrated by someone other than the murderer. The two of us then lit into the subject. We told the assembled crew why it was quite clear that the tape was the product of a hoaxer. Because what the person on the tape said seemed totally inconsistent with the crimes as Domé had described those killings to us. We thought that the killer was not the type of extroverted man who would be communicating with the police, that he was the quiet, introverted, woman-hating type. Didn't they understand that his style of quickly rendering his victims unconscious and his post-mortem mutilations showed that hatred of women? The voices around the table took on tones of distinct challenge. If the tape sender was not the killer, then what sort of man did we think the killer was? We were being asked to do an instant profile, just the sort of thing we are most reluctant to do. We protested that we didn't have crime scene photos, but the officers gave us more details and would not be denied. Put up or shut up. Fortified by another round of beer, we winged it. The killer, we said, was undoubtedly in his late 20s or early 30s, probably a school dropout or a man who had not been through higher education. We postulated that he was able to enter the areas of the murders in a way that rendered him near invisible. He got there without people paying attention to him, because his business regularly took him to various areas. He would be a cab driver or a truck driver or a mail carrier or possibly even a policeman. We thought that he was not a total loner and would have a relationship with a woman, even though the absence of sexual penetration of the victim suggested that he had some serious mental problems that had taken years to develop. By the time we were finished elucidating this rump profile and defending our conclusions, Domet invited us to go to Yorkshire to look at the crime scene photos. We were unable to do so because we had to get back to Quantico, so I invited him to bring the crime scene materials to us in the United States as soon as he could. He didn't come, and the materials didn't arrive. I later learned that Chief Inspector Oldfield was adamantly opposed to showing us those materials and totally disagreed with our rump profile. He could not stomach our explanation of the crimes and the fact that the audio tape demonstrated so easily that he had been misled and that thousands of police man-hours had been wasted in a fruitless search for the wrong man. Some time, and more victims later, Oldfield was replaced as chief of the investigation. The hunt for the killer had cost nearly $10 million. The police had questioned 200,000 people, made 30,000 searches of homes and 180,000 vehicle searches. It was not until 1981 that the case of the Yorkshire Ripper was solved. During a routine police check in a prostitution area, a man was stopped, and evidence later connected him to 13 killings and 7 other assaults. As we had predicted, Peter Sutcliffe was a 35-year-old married truck driver for an engineering firm, and he regularly traveled around the country for the purposes of his job. After Sutcliffe's apprehension and conviction, some further spade work finally revealed the identity of the man who had perpetrated the audio tape hoax. He was a retired police officer who hated Chief Inspector George Oldfield and had sent the tape to vex him. In the small town of Genoa, Ohio, in late February of 1980, teenager Deborah Sue Vine left her friend's house at 8 in the evening and headed for her own home 2 blocks away. She never arrived. The next morning, her father, vice president of a local bank, reported her missing. A search of the area between her home and the friend's home turned up one of Deborah's mittens. Later that morning, an aunt who was staying at the Vine home received a telephone call from someone she described as a white male in his late teens or early 20s with a southern or New England accent. He said, "We have your daughter. We want $80,000 or you will never see her again." The aunt asked to speak to Deborah, and the caller hung up. The aunt told police that because of the unique characteristics of the Genoa telephone system, she believed the call had been a local rather than a long-distance call. The following day, Deborah's father received another call at his residence from a man he thought was speaking with a Mexican accent. The man claimed to have Deborah and wanted $50,000. Mr. Vine, too, asked to speak with his daughter, and the caller said that Vine would just have to trust him and that instructions for delivery of the money would be given later. The phone call was recorded. Because ransom demands had been made, the FBI was able to enter the case. Genoa is 20 miles from Toledo, and the Cleveland office of the FBI became involved. What seemed like a big break came the next day, 3 days after the abduction. Some of Deborah's clothing was recovered about 2 miles west of Genoa at the side of a county road, and the remainder was found the following day on another county road in the same general area. Near her sweater was a crumpled-up handwritten map on yellow legal paper. The map depicted the general area where the clothing was found, and markings on it seemed to indicate that a search ought to be made near a bridge over a river. The authorities went to the bridge and found tire tracks and 2 sets of footprints that indicated someone had dragged something to the bridge. A police dog, brought along to sniff, was quite excited by these findings, but a search of the river found nothing. The police thought it certain they had found the dump site of the body, and they continued to search along the river. A tape recorder had been set up to monitor the Vine family's phone, but no further messages from the abductor were received just then. In my early days at the Bureau, I had been assigned to the Cleveland office and still knew many of the agents there. As so often happened, I was in the area of the crime, conducting a road school, and the Cleveland office learned about this and contacted me. From FBI agents Dick Wren and George Steinbach, I learned the details of the abduction, such as were then known, heard about the sequence of finding the clothing, looked at the map, listened to the tape recording of the ransom demand phone call, and came to an immediate conclusion. The clues had been deliberately staged and were misleading. The police had been directed to the supposed dump site by a detailed map, and they were meant to believe that the body had been thrown into the river. When I encounter a deliberate staging, the immediate need is to look in precisely the opposite direction from the one the perpetrator wants me to face. Since the caller avowed that Deborah was alive and that there would be more ransom demands, I told my colleagues from the Cleveland office and the local Genoa authorities that the staging indicated that Deborah was almost certainly dead. Given the usual patterns of these sorts of crimes, it was likely she had been picked up by someone and then raped or sexually assaulted, and most likely had been killed during the assault. It was probably not a well-planned abduction, more of a spur-of-the-moment thing, and the death had been unexpected. After the killing, the killer had had some moments of panic, then had settled down to make a plan for keeping the authorities at bay. The abductor must have felt that any real investigation of the victim would lead to him as a likely suspect, and he had staged the dropping of the clothing and the map and the tire and drag marks by the river as attempts to steer the investigation in precisely the wrong direction. "He's trying to lead you to a place where you'll never find the girl," I concluded. The phone call also seemed deliberately phony, especially the Hispanic accent. "Hey, Mom, I need the money right now." It seemed like the comic Jose Jimenez accent, not the real thing. The tape was sent on to Dr. Murray Mirren of Syracuse University, the Bureau's psycholinguistic consultant, for more precise analysis. But in light of all the other evidence, I was certain that it was just another aspect of the staging. I thought to myself, this is a community of 2,000 people. The likelihood is that the abductor is so visible to the police that he knows the investigation will stumble across him unless he keeps it away from him by every means possible. I sat down and worked up a profile of the likely offender. He would be an athletically built white male in his late 20s to early 30s. I thought he was athletically built because he had been large enough to abduct Deborah from the street without interference, and also because I guessed that he was the sort of antisocial personality who compensated for his personality by muscle building, driving souped-up cars, and wearing cowboy boots. Reasoning along the same lines, I described him as a macho, aggressive sort of individual, one who would be very neat in his appearance and might well have the reputation of a ladies' man. Believing that this was a spur-of-the-moment crime, I thought that the pre-crime stresses most likely had to do with the man's trouble with a woman. This had been an affront to him, and in reaction, he had grabbed the first attractive, vulnerable young woman he came across. The ransom notes, drawings, and staging of the scene made it a virtual certainty that the perpetrator had been someone extremely familiar with police procedure. I postulated that the abductor had been a police officer, a private detective, or a security officer, but that he was now unemployed, and had been so for 6 to 9 months. I thought it likely that he'd been in a number of scrapes in his life, one of which might have led to the termination of his most recent employment, and possibly to the end of his relationship with a woman, since I was equally certain that he would have been divorced at least once, and in trouble with a woman, either a former wife or a girlfriend. During this unemployed period, I guessed he would also have had a scrape with the law that would have resulted in an arrest. For most people whose personalities tend to get them fired, troubles do not come singly, and they pyramid after such a basic prop as a job is removed. This man's rage was great enough so that he would most likely have been unable to stay out of trouble once he had lost his job and his wife or girlfriend. I guessed that as an ex-law enforcement man, he would be driving something that resembled a police car, a late model automobile, a sedan painted in dark colors with a CB radio or a device to monitor police frequencies, and the antenna on the car positioned on the rear fender or in the center of the hood. As the listener will have discerned from many of the other cases reported in this book, many killers like to take on the color of authority in order to control situations and victims. In some instances, and not as rarely as I would like, since I've spent my professional life in law enforcement and have great respect for the vast majority of officers who uphold the law, the same urge to use the color of authority for nefarious purposes is present in people who manage to get themselves on police forces. Sometimes it happens that an officer is kicked off one force for infractions that don't quite add up to an indictable crime, but are serious nonetheless. He tells the next force to which he applies that he was severed, say, because of a personality conflict with a superior. Certainly a common enough occurrence, and manages to get hired again. In Chapter 6, I discussed Gerard Schaefer, whose employment history as a police officer fit that pattern. In the Genoa case, my profile produced two prime suspects, one of whom was a 31-year-old officer recently fired by the Genoa Police Department for cohabiting with an 18-year-old girl, and a second who had at one time been with a neighboring police department, had most recently been a railroad detective, and who had been fired from that last job 9 months earlier. The first man had been hanging around the fringes of the investigation and making himself overly cooperative. That sort of behavior often masks guilt, because the offender tries to learn what the police know so he can stay one step ahead of the authorities. Though I advised the Cleveland office against a polygraph on either of the likely suspects, because true psychopaths are frequently able to beat the box, the Cleveland office decided to give the first suspect a lie detector test. Then they called me to tell me the suspect had passed. I asked whether his alibi had been verified, and the answer was, "What for? He passed the polygraph test." I requested that they verify his alibi nonetheless, and that was done. This first former police officer was eliminated as a suspect. The second man's name was Jack Gall, and he seemed to fit the profile extraordinarily well. He was having difficulty with his former wife, with whom he jointly owned a several-cabin resort on a Michigan lake that they were trying to sell. While in Michigan, after his separation from the railroad detective force, Gall had been arrested for a burglary. He owned a late-model Monte Carlo, complete with CB radio, and so on. In fact, he fit the profile so precisely that it was decided to keep only a loose surveillance on him in hopes that he would tip his hand. Several weeks went by before the victim's father received another phone call at his residence from the man with the Mexican accent, telling him there would shortly be instructions on where to drop the ransom money. One of the Genoa officers on the case, listening later to the tape, said that he was now sure the caller was Jack Gall, because Gall had sometimes regaled fellow officers with his Mexican-accented stories. A fourth call came the next day, April 10th, and was successfully traced to a payphone on the outside wall of a Woolco store a few miles from Genoa. Surveillance was put on that payphone in hopes that the kidnapper would use it again. That simple, obvious step led directly to the conclusion of the case. Watching the phone paid off almost immediately. The next afternoon, agents in a van parked near the wall phone saw Gall approach and make a call. At the same time, Mr. Vine received a call at his home. The caller said, "Tonight's the night," and told Vine that precise instructions would follow in the evening. Agents in the van snapped photos of Gall making the call at the same time that the message was being recorded from Vine's phone. After hanging up, Gall reached into his shirt and drew out a folded-up note, which he attached right under the phone booth table, being careful to do so with white-gloved hands that would not leave fingerprints for the police to collect and identify. Gall then sped away. After pursuing him for a few blocks, the agents decided not to track him farther, because he seemed to be tail-conscious. Anyhow, his residence was known and was also being watched. In the evening, Vine received a call telling him to go to the Woolco phone booth, where he would find further instructions. They were in the note taped under the table, and that note was the first in a series of nine that Gall had block lettered and cashed in similar places. Vine and some agents hidden in his car were taken on a several-hour chase all around the county, kept running from payphone to payphone, told to switch vehicles, and so on, until they were at last directed to a location where Vine was supposed to leave a suitcase full of money and be told where to retrieve his daughter. The whole chase was watched by a Bureau aircraft and sophisticated surveillance machinery, and Vine finally left the suitcase at a remote spot near a river. It was not picked up, nor was his daughter returned. 5 hours after making the journey to the river, Vine retrieved the suitcase and took it home. The cruel charade had been tolerated on the slim hope that the kidnapper still held Deborah alive, but it produced nothing. This part of the hoax was mounted, it seemed, in an attempt to give Gall an alibi, since during the several-hour chase from phone booth to phone booth, Gall's car was observed in his own driveway. That actually did not provide him with an alibi, since all the latter moves were directed by the series of 9 notes, and Gall could have called the payphones from his home number. Though the body of Deborah Sue Vine had not been found, the authorities now had ample evidence on which to indict Gall for extortion, and they did so. He was quickly convicted and sentenced. Genoa Chief of Police Gary Truman recently told me that he believes this case would have gone unsolved if the authorities had not had my profile and the assistance of the FBI. The police pursued Gall for murder, especially after the victim's body was eventually found. Deborah's body was discovered in a deserted location near to Genoa, but opposite from where the X marks the spot site had been indicated on the phony map. The body was wrapped in an electric blanket, and there was hope that this blanket could be identified as one stolen in the Michigan burglary for which Gall had once been charged. As of this writing, the murder charge has not been brought, but Gall is still incarcerated for extortion. The veneer of incomprehensibility in a crime scene not only covers the evidence in the cases of violent murder and rape that make up the bulk of this chapter, but also in cases that are far less bloody, far more common, and seldom make the headlines. One such interesting crime scene became a recent assignment for me in 1991, months after I'd retired from the FBI. A psychologist in a major city on the West Coast had been retained by an insurance company to evaluate a claim of $270,000 for damages to a home, damages apparently caused by vandals. Faced with a crime scene that was difficult to assess, the psychologist wanted me to evaluate it and to do a profile of the likely offender or offenders. I was a good choice because, in 30 years of law enforcement work, I'd seen hundreds of vandalism scenes on military bases and installations, government buildings, private property, virtually every sort of place that could be hit by vandals. The psychologist planned to send me color photos of the scene, the police reports on the incident, and his comments on the matter. I told him to go ahead and send the photos and police reports, but to hold back his own comments until I'd made my evaluation. That was the procedure we'd followed for years in the FBI. In an attempt to give an independent opinion, we'd try not to look at anyone else's conclusions before making our own evaluation. We'd routinely ask police departments seeking our help to send us only first-hand reports and photos. If they insisted on shipping their conclusions anyway, we'd ask to have them sent in a separate and sealed envelope. And once we received that envelope, we'd put it aside until after we'd made our own judgments. Any other way of working would have prejudiced independent examination of the evidence. A few days after my conversation with the psychologist, a packet of photos and police reports arrived in the mail, and I spread them out on a desk and began to peruse them. There were dozens of photos of a single home that was in a complete mess. At one time, it had been a lovely suburban house, but it had been trashed, apparently by vandals. The owners were seeking more than $250,000 from the insurer. That was a sum large enough to prod the insurer to obtain some outside opinions on the damage. Peering at the photos and reading the police reports, most observers would see at first glance that the home had been overturned and was in total chaos, with spray-painted graffiti, upended and broken valuables, smashed door jams. Damage was spread through the living room, halls, kitchen, main bedroom, and bath. Walls, furniture, paintings, clothing, vases, jade carvings, and other items had been broken and defaced. Curtains were down. Glass over art prints had been cracked. Spray paint graffiti could be made out in various locations on walls, furniture, and the like, in single word clusters such as asshole, ass, suck, cunt. There was also a two-word inscription, fuck me. You may have seen such a scene yourself, though probably not in real life. More likely you saw it in a film or on a television show with the damage attributed to teenage males, misunderstood rebels who were acting out their aggression against society. It's a familiar fictional theme. These photos didn't show me that, however. First glances can be deceiving. The vandalism wasn't exactly what it appeared to be, and certainly didn't reflect what I knew about teenage male offenders. Vandals usually travel in groups, packs if you like, composed of a strong leader and several inadequate and subordinate followers who take their cues from the leader. Sometimes a vandal is a single individual, a lone, antisocial adolescent male whose act is a deliberate lashing out at society at large, or against an authority figure known to him. Damage from such vandals is usually random, indiscriminate, and accompanied by obscene writings and sometimes by obscene acts performed at the location of the vandalism. The graffiti in particular will reflect the interests and lifestyle of the vandal or vandals. In most cases of adolescent male vandals, these graffiti will have to do with musical groups or will incorporate symbols of satanic or occult origin, such as pentagrams or inverted crosses. Iconography in music that we often find to have attracted the focus of emotionally unfulfilled youth. Occasionally, in conjunction with such graffiti, we'll find that sexual acts have been carried out at the scene, acts that reflect the vandal's state of mind in that place. He feels he has total freedom of action in the arena he is trashing, that he is entitled to take women's undergarments and masturbate in them, or defecate on the rug or urinate in a closet. Theft of items is common, and food and alcohol belonging to the owner of the site are usually consumed right there and then. Actions that also reflect the vandal's feelings of entitlement. As a matter of course, in the usual teenage male vandalism act, damage is total, and few items of value or endearment survive. These photos, however, showed me a different pattern of vandalism. The destruction was not total, but selective. Some of the paintings were damaged, yes, but in some instances only the canvases were damaged and the ornate frames were left intact. The real damage was to paintings that did not seem particularly valuable. Some Indian art prints, objects whose value I happened to know about, were damaged in an interesting way. The glass over the prints was broken, but the prints underneath were left unharmed. The most intriguing lack of damage was to a large oil painting of a little girl. It was left untouched. Certain vases, statues, and jade carvings seemed to have been tipped over onto the floor with some care, and none appeared to have been broken. The usual teenage vandal would not have left such art objects intact. Moreover, an entire shelf of plants had not been touched. Although the kitchen and the bathroom were extensively trashed, there had been no real damage to countertops, mirrors, appliances, or fixtures. Doorknobs had been damaged, but not the doors themselves. Other than some minor ceiling damage, no wallboards had been kicked or knocked out. Such kicking is a favorite act of adolescent male vandals. A curtain rod seemed to have been placed gently down on the floor without harming or wrinkling the curtains on it. Some clothing had been damaged, but the torn items did not appear to be particularly stylish or valuable. Was it possible that the vandals had missed virtually all of the expensive or sentimentally important items? The spray painting was also incomplete and inconsistent with the acts of true vandals. It seemed to have been directed at locations that could be easily cleaned, painted over, or, in the case of furniture, reupholstered. The pattern of the spraying went around art objects and the more delicate valuables. No fetish sex acts had taken place in this particular vandalized suburban home. Finally, there was the graffiti. Single-word obscenities are not common to the usual teenage vandal. Today's young trashers are more apt to leave slogans and names of musical groups, such as Slayer, Motley Crue, Public Enemy, or Terminator X. Among the specific terms used by the spray painter was cunt, and in teenage usage, this term has been replaced by pussy. Last of all, and especially meaningful, I thought, was the inscription, "Fuck me." "Fuck you" would have been more typical of a hostile and arrogant young